So good evening, everyone. It's nice to see some of you by open windows, outdoors. We've spent this past week in the company of some hermits, some people in their huts over many centuries. I guess maybe 1,500 years span. For those, wave your hand if you were at least in any part of last week's retreat, even if not the whole thing. Yes, a little bit, some of you. Yeah, we called the Mountains and Waters online retreat. The person in the hut after the last two lines of a poem called "The Grass Roof Hermitage" by Sherto, who wrote also the poem that we chant frequently, Harmony of Relative and Absolute, or Merging of Difference and Unity. I can never remember which translation we changed it years ago. And those last two lines are, if I have it correctly, If you want to know the person in the hut, or if you want to understand the person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. Do not separate from this body. If you wish to know the hermit in the hut. And the other line, very important line, is not sticking to outside, inside, or in between. And so during the week, we kind of looked at our practice inside the hut, outside the hut, how permeable is our hut, and how we practice back and forth simultaneously in the world of samsara, the world of nirvana. Lots of different ways we can understand that. And so just before that week, we had a series of a five-week series of our women's retreat, and we practiced with some wonderful stories from our women ancestors in the Dharma. So when we came to the hermits in the hut, it kept I kept being struck by how little there was available on women hermits. None of the ones we looked at were women. So I thought, well, I have to do something to remedy this, to balance this. And I realized there's not much historically, and there are lots of reasons for that. In Asian cultures and in European cultures at the same time, it's not exclusive to Asia, women were expected, not only expected, obliged to marry and produce children. It was a social obligation, even a moral obligation. They had limited mobility at times. The women in the nobility had limited mobility. The women in the lower, the peasant classes worked all the time. Limited economic autonomy, limited education. You know, the hermits that we practiced with this past week were all poets and writers, so they left us records of their practice, their hermitage practice. So women, there may have been, I like to think that all through the ages, there were old, wise women living on maybe on the outskirts of the village, who had great knowledge of healing plants and served their villages quietly with a great wisdom and compassion. And they're unknown to us. That's what, you know, when we say our women ancestors, known and unknown, named and unnamed. So I think that there have been, you know, very wise women throughout time. And women who dared to live alone, and there have always been risks to that. You know, certainly in Europe, women were burned at the stake for daring to live alone and to pursue wisdom and spiritual practice. So anyway, I just thought for a start, I would just patch together some bits of my findings thus far. The other thing I want to do is read, you know, from contemporary or modern day 20th century and maybe earlier women who lived lives of solitude for some period of time and lives of spiritual practice and wrote about it. So I have some possibilities there. But tonight I just want to share with you two examples, historical examples, and there are not many. Many of the women, and they were all along women in the Dharma, practiced in community rather than in solitude, in convents, and had very limited mobility and autonomy. So one example for tonight is a Chinese nun. This is from this Beata Grant. I'll hold this up so you can see the beautiful picture. Beata Grant is a scholar in St. Louis, Missouri, professor of Chinese language and literature, who's done some great research into Chinese nuns from the mostly 16th, 17th century. And this is a book of their poetry. There's another one where she gives more of an historical account. So this one, her name is Xing Chi. She's born in 1606 in Hunan province. Her father was she was from the educated class. Her father was a scholar official who was interested in Buddhism and took her along on his travels to visit various teachers and temples. She told the story that the night she was conceived, her father had a dream that a Buddhist monk came to his door asking for food and shelter, and he invited him in. So, as was expected, she married against her preference. And she was already very well educated and accomplished in writing poetry by then. She apparently had several children. And then her husband died. Now, in those days, typically the children would have kind of belonged to the family of the husband. And so often widows did not fare so well. But what she did was moved into a kind of cloister on a little hermitage on the family's property. And after a while, she sought out a chan or Zen master and practiced with him, and then ordained at the age of 33 and moved to a little hermitage on Mount Hung to be close to her teacher. And then her teacher died just a few years later, prematurely. It says here, from eating poisonous greens after the area was overrun by invading Qing troops and all the agricultural crops were destroyed. You know, so we often hear in these stories of terrible disruptions, war, famine, you know, pestilence that these our Zen ancestors lived through. So she traveled. She traveled to the Southeast China and visited a number of teachers and eventually received Dharma transmission and became a teacher herself and led a convent and was very well regarded. But according to her poetry, we have the impression that in her old age she returned to her beloved Mount Hung for her final years. In this book, there's a series of verses entitled, there's 10 verses entitled Living in Seclusion in the Nanyue Mountains. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's really quite beautiful. Just read maybe a couple of the verses. From the mountain stream, the wind gusts fiercely. When the heart is empty, each and everything is still. There is no noise here of clattering carts and horses. It is far from both neighbors and dusty worldly cares. The leaves fall as if autumn had grown old. The trees are bared, revealing the waterfall. I've abandoned all ambitions. Now seagull and egret are as close to me as the most intimate of friends. When the sun comes out, it warms the body through, and when the wind rises, it cools off the great earth. The human heart must face so very many obstacles that only the way of the sages can scatter and dispel. Like white jade, from the beginning it is completely white. Like yellow gold, it needs no refining to become yellow. Whether ancient or modern, it undergoes no change, and in each and every place reveals the eternally real. And this is the last verse. The late autumn moon lights up the forest. The mountain mists fill the secluded woods. I love to look at this crystal clear landscape. It helps me sustain an empty and clear mind. On the flat moss, I can sit in stable meditation as the wind whips its way deep into the woods. An old nun comes to see how I am getting along. We light some incense, play a bit on the zither. So like some of the hermits we heard about last week, she loved her solitude, but enjoyed a visit now and then. You know, these old hermits were not, they had friends who came to visit, and they would go into the village themselves and often support the villagers in various ways. So it was much more, these hermits had much more of a reciprocal arrangement, relationship with the world than we might imagine. And they often wrote about both loneliness. They would write poems, if you remember, right, some of the ones we read last week. They knew loneliness, but they also loved solitude and were quite happy in their own company. So that's just a little taste of Xing Chu. And the other one I wanted to share with you tonight is a Japanese nun and poet and potter named Rengetsu. Rengetsu means lotus moon. And she lived almost 200 years later. Sorry, did I tell you? Xing Chu was born in 1606. Doesn't say when she died, but she lived a long life. So 17th century, and Rengetsu was born in 1791. And she likewise was... raised in an upper-class family, but she was born... her mother was, kind of a geisha or courtesan, and her father was a high-ranking samurai who arranged for her to be adopted in infancy by a lay priest in a Pure Land temple in Kyoto. I'm not exactly sure what lay priests meant in those days, but I believe that Pure Land priests married even in those days. So that might mean, because he was married, so this couple adopted this little girl and raised her very lovingly, educated her in literature, calligraphy. She learned the game of Go. You know, with the black and white discs on a kind of chessboard kind of game of strategy, which was very much male territory, but he taught her that, and martial arts. And then she went to serve as an attendant in the castle of a lord near Kyoto. And then she married, arranged marriage when she was 16. She had three children in succession. They all died very young. And apparently her husband was dissolute, as the word goes. Doesn't say how. And she separated from him. And then he died. So she's still very, very young and experienced great loss. She married again, and this time happily. Had two children, or a child, and then was pregnant with another child, and her husband died. At that point, at the age of 33, she shaved her head and became a Buddhist nun and lived with her adopted father in a hermitage on the grounds of the Pure Land Temple with her young children, even though she was, you know, ordained at this point. She lived with her young family, and they too died, and her adoptive father died. So incredible losses, unbelievable. You know, we can't imagine that degree of child mortality that still occurred in relatively recent history. It's really, you know, only the 20th century where that changed. With sanitation and antibiotics. So incredible losses. And when her adoptive father died, she no longer had status at the temple. So she had to leave. And this is what she wrote. She said, since I was poor, she thought about teaching Go. I mean, she was very accomplished. Teaching the game of Go, but she realized she couldn't do that as a woman, that men wouldn't accept her as a Go master. Also, of course, she was a legendary beauty, so that was problematic. It is said that she eventually pulled out her teeth to make herself less attractive, or had her teeth pulled. So here's what she said. Since I was poor and there was nothing I could do, I dabbled with clay, making kibisho. Kibisho are little roundish teapots for serving sencha or green tea. Not the thick formal tea ceremony. See, there's a less formal tea ceremony that she made teapots and cups for. She said, one at a time, they were very humble, and the shapes were unrefined. The poems I carved on them I wrote when I had a moment free. I never had much free time. She was known for not staying in one place for long, for having all her worldly goods able to be packed in one box so she could move. She apparently moved 13 times in 1 year. And one of her poems goes, "A floating cloud, people call me, drifting here and there. But that is my way, not wanting to fade away, stuck in one place." So she became incredibly prolific, making pottery and inscribing her poems on them. She didn't write haiku, she wrote waka. Haiku are the haiku pattern of syllables is 5-7-5. Waka is 5-7-5-7-7. So they're a little longer than haiku. And waka preceded haiku in historical development. I have some, have a little slideshow I'm going to show you of Rengetsu's work. And I'll read you a few of her poems. So we can imagine that she stayed in many different rough and tumble-down places. She kind of reminds me of a cross between homeless Kodo, who Michael talked about, and Ryokan, who I talked about, who was a wonderful calligrapher and gave away his calligraphy and poems, as Rengetsu did with her. She was also known as a fine calligrapher as well as potter. "Deep in the mountains, a single branch of maple near the eaves of my hut marks the beginning of the days of autumn. Clad in black robes, I should have no attractions to the shapes and scents of this world, but how can I keep my vows gazing at today's crimson maple leaves? From dawn to dusk, spending the day gathering clay, surely Buddha would not think this a trifling matter. Reside in a living landscape and it becomes yours. Daikon dry along the fence, trees full of chestnuts brush against the eaves. Taking the fragile little handmade thing to sell, how lonely it looks in the marketplace. These have little titles. I haven't been giving you the titles. "Storm deep in the mountains. The roar awakens me from a peaceful slumber, but then the fierce mountain wind blows away all the dust in my heart. Later, she did come to rest in a hermitage outside a temple in Kyoto. And eventually that was, and she continued to be very, very prolific in her work and well known. And in the end, lived in a little tea room, a little tea house to the side of a temple in Kyoto. Lived to be 84. She lived to know the opening of Japan to the West, which involved some strife and conflict and the threat of civil war. As the shogunate, the Tokugawa shogunate fell and the emperor was restored to leadership. So it was called the Restoration, the Meiji Restoration, 1868. And she wrote this on the fighting during the Restoration. "To those who strike and those who are struck, keep this in your hearts. Are we not all people of the same beautiful land?" So she spoke out about current affairs a little bit as well towards the end of her life. Let me just... Oh, the other amazing thing about her is she became so popular. Her work became so popular. This was the time that the merchant class was really into tea ceremony. So they would, you know, her work was popular for collectors and tea people in tea ceremony to buy or acquire. But rather than becoming rich and famous, she actually assisted those who were copying her work by adding her own signature and inscribing her poems on the fakes, or showing the young up and coming potters how to imitate her style. So she had no interest in what we now call artistic or intellectual property rights. So it makes it really hard for collectors now to know for sure if it's authentic Rengetsu or not. Her death poem was, "How I hope to pass away while gazing at a round moon in a cloudless sky, shining over lotus flowers in full bloom." Okay, let me see if I can show you a little bit of her work here. What? That didn't work. Bear with me. You know what I need to do? I think I need to open this first.
That's it, yeah.
Can you see this? Can people see this? Oh, yeah, okay, good. Okay, good, you can see it. Okay, so this is a 20th century artist's depiction of Rengetsu, inscribing poems on her tea bowls. And I don't know if I can make it just so that show the slideshow. I thought I knew how to do this.
Slideshow.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's not working. Okay, you'll just have to see it the way it is. So
okay.
Here. Hmm.
If you click slideshow and then from beginning, it should open up.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. That's it. That's what you do. Okay, here we go. And here's one of her bowls, and you can see her calligraphy on it.
It's fabulous.
So that would be a tea bowl, a tea, what you drink tea. And this is actually a sake cup. That's probably larger than its actual size. And I tried to find the poem that this one is. It didn't give online, but it's Yamazato no, it's Mountain Village. I tried to match it up. And there's, with one in my book, but I couldn't find it. But you see her calligraphy. It's quite expressive. And it's also mostly using the Japanese phonetic script. There are some Chinese characters, but mostly it's hiragana. Okay, and she did a lot of scrolls and scroll paintings as well. That shows you the scroll, and there's the hut, the painting of the hut on the cliff.
Fabulous.
And unfortunately, I don't have a translation for that one. I really like this one. I had never seen it before. I found it online. If you look at the close-up, that is a fox in a nun's habit. A fox is a trickster in Japanese culture. And it says a trickster in Sagano fields at twilight.
Wow.
So So that's when foxes and tanuki, which are also tricksters, tanuki is sort of in the raccoon, sort of like a raccoon, but not. And they will appear as in priest robes, or in this case in nun's robes. It's very unusual to see one in nun's robes. And the way you can tell is you see their tail sticking out. They're not very good at hiding their tails. And they play all kinds of tricks on people. There's some great, great folk tales about them, foxes and tanuki. And there's one of her teapots. River, we're hearing all your O's. It's very sweet. There's one of her teapots, and this is a painting of her in her old age by her dear friend, Tomioka Tessai, who became one of Japan's greatest artists. And I really love that picture as well. So I guess, yeah, that's it. So you can find, if you just Google Rengetsu, you can find more of her work online if you want to take a look. When the bush warblers come to the capital, I'd like to lend them my little hut, plum flowers in full bloom.
Kate?
Yes.
Will you please spell her name?
Rengetsu.
Thank you.
Lotus Moon. Pretty great Dharma name. And if we were in person, I would let you look through this beautiful book put out by the National Gallery of Australia, which with from an exhibition of her work, lots of beautiful photographs and translations. I just opened to this one. The evanescence of this floating world, I feel over and over, it is the hardest to be the one left behind. You know, remembering all the losses that she had. And if I can find it. Often on her teapots and work, she would write the same poem over and over. This is her most famous one. No place at the inn. Human beings have a hard time in life, I feel. But sleeping beneath the blossoms and the hazy moon consoles me. So, thank you, everyone. That's just a little sampling from a Zen poet. Oh, I say Zen because she actually, she connected to and lived in both Pure Land Zen and esoteric Buddhist temples. All three were meaningful to her. She wasn't particularly aligned only with one tradition. So it was a bit of a ramble, but I just wanted to supplement our week from of hermits last week. So thank you all, and I think what we have time to do, what I had thought